Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, Frische für alle. Zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche Zespri Sangold Kiwi. Das Stück für nur 55 Cent. Oder dunkle Tafeltrauben. 500 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Stu does America.
I dare you. Watch us on YouTube. It's youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Luckily, there's no... just so you know, there's no other content on YouTube. It's pretty much just our show. So check it out there, because if not, you'll have nothing else to watch on YouTube. StuDoesAmerica.com actually exists as well. You can watch that. You get a membership to Blaze TV and use the promo code Stu. Get $20 off. What a deal. Take advantage of it now. It's a great community to join, and we would love to have you as part of it. Ari Shulman is here. He's going to outline some of the rot in our aviation industry. Doge uncovers some new massive fraud between Joe Biden and Stacey Abrams. Amazing story. We'll get to that. But we're going to start by doing the left's collapsing climate narrative. Now, I'm always fascinated by the climate change stuff because it is supposed to be the worst thing that could ever happen to us. It's going to wipe out humanity. It's going to liquidate you and me and all of your friends. But in reality, I don't know if they actually believe any of this stuff. And let me give you an example of this today. We're going to start with Nicola, not Ricola. It's not in the hills somewhere and someone's making cough drops and has one of those loud horns and goes, Ricola. It's not that. It's Nicola. Yes, this Nicola was a car company. Remember them? And a big EV manufacturer, EV maker worth more than Ford, Chrysler, and Dodge combined just 4 years ago. Files for bankruptcy. What an incredible shock. And who would have thought that this could happen? Because if you think about it, really, wait a minute. Everyone loves electric vehicles. They're going to solve all of our problems when it comes to global warming. This is a massive, massive step in the right direction. How could this company fail? Well, it had its share of problems, boys and girls. The company once hailed as a Tesla challenger filed for bankruptcy on Wednesday and it plans to wind down operations. Nikola is the latest EV startup to collapse. The latest, because there's been a lot of them. Sluggish demand, huge costs, and investors running for the hills are to blame. Fisker, Proterra, Lordstown Motors are other EV startups that went public during the pandemic, promising to revolutionize the sector. They've also failed for bankruptcy in recent years. Fisker's done it twice, too. Didn't they, like, launch, collapse, launch again, and collapse again? Some of their cars look really cool, I will say that. Now, how could this happen? How could this possibly happen to Nikola? I mean, if you think about it, Tesla is a car company. They make electric vehicles. They're successful. That's the last name of Tesla. His first name was Nikola. What if we just make a company called Nikola? And then we just say, that one's going to be successful too. How could it possibly fail? Well, you're going to be shocked to hear there's a little bit of fraud, a little bit of graft going on. When it comes to the electric vehicle market. In 2020, the company went public before even producing a single vehicle for the market. At one point, Nikola's worth hit $30 billion, and it made more valuable than Ford. Its rise was fueled by bold promises from founder Trevor Milton, who was later convicted of securities fraud in 2022 for misleading investors about the company's zero-emissions technology. Phoenix, Arizona-based Nikola delivered its first vehicle in December 2021. A series of fire incidents, oops, involving its electric trucks in 2023 resulted in a recall of all of its vehicles and raised safety concerns. Nikola ramped up production of its hydrogen-powered trucks in 2024, but still lost hundreds of thousands of dollars on every vehicle it sold as fleet operators were reluctant to invest in electric truck adoption amid high borrowing costs. And it went further than that. It was also just kind of like crazy stuff happening. I mean, this is like, I feel like it would be in an episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. The company captured headlines after it admitted to doctoring a promotional YouTube video. In the video, the manufacturer rolled a truck down a hill, claiming it was operating under its own power, but in reality, it was simply taking advantage of gravity. Here's the great thing. Gravity is available for everyone. So as long as you're only taking your vehicle down the hill, there's no limit to how many emission-free miles you could drive. That's always a good thing. Initially, big investors, including GM, flowed cash into Nikola's projects. GM initially took an 11% stake in the company. Nikola lost $200 million producing 80 trucks last year. Now, that's impressive, I gotta say. If you started an electric vehicle company tomorrow with no knowledge at all about the industry or anything else, don't you think you could make 80 vehicles before you lost $200 million? I feel like I could. They may not be great, but I feel like I'd only lose $150 million. I feel like I could pull that off. So far, the company has produced just over 300 production vehicles since its inception. Not good. I'd consider all of that to be suboptimal. That's not the news that you need. And that's the problem here, because we're talking about something that's really, really serious. We need, desperately need, electric car companies to save us from this incredible threat of global warming. This is like the worst thing that could possibly happen. And don't take my word for it. Take Joe Biden's.
You know, I've seen firsthand what the reports make clear. The devastating toll of climate change and its existential threat to all of us, and is the ultimate threat to humanity, climate change.
Yes, it's the ultimate threat to humanity. I mean, that's why it's so important to not have a Nikola go down, because this is the biggest thing that we face. We've been hearing this from Democrats for years and years and years and years and years. The greatest existential threat we face is global warming. It's really, really important for us to get control of this, because if we don't, who knows what could happen? It's a catastrophic event for all human beings. And that's why it's really important. But it's also kind of interesting as to why all of a sudden Elon Musk is the worst person in the world to the left, because he's not Nikola. He's Tesla. He's Tesla. He's the guy who was able to actually succeed in making an electric vehicle company. Now, he did name it after a guy who failed in business over and over and over again, but that's a whole totally different story. So did Nikola, and they followed much closer in the footsteps of actual Tesla, at least when it came to business acumen. There's a new poll out, How Americans View Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. It's a fascinating poll, because it just tells us so much about the way our media works, the way our politics works, and honestly, the way that the left actually views things, because they tell us a lot of stuff, but then they do the complete opposite quite often. Here's the poll. Americans have a more negative than positive views of both Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. To take Zuckerberg first, he's just paired in this. We're not really talking about him today. But it sucks for Zuckerberg because, frankly, he's at only 25% have a favorable opinion of poor Mark Zuckerberg, and 67% have a negative. That's much worse than Elon Musk, who has a 42% positive and a 54% negative. Now, one of the reasons why this is because Elon Musk now at least has conservatives who like him. Back in the day, it was only liberals who liked Elon Musk. Now it's only conservatives who liked him. Seems like nobody likes poor Mark Zuckerberg. Now, he's making a move. He's trying to change things up. Maybe that'll be successful and he'll win over conservatives, but he'll probably lose a bunch of liberals in that process. You feel a little bit bad for Zuckerberg. But when it comes to Elon Musk, only 42% think of this guy positively. Now, I feel like I have a relatively nuanced view of Elon Musk. I mentioned a bunch of times, you know, I've read multiple books on the guy. I think he's a fascinating figure. But I'm not a fanboy, I would say. There's a lot of things I don't like about Musk. I don't think some of the things he did running his companies, I don't think were particularly good. I don't think he treated his employees particularly well at times. Obviously, he has issues with handling people and, you know, in these social circumstances that, you know, might lead to him having a poor treatment of some employees. I don't think that, you know, like, for example, Twitter has undoubtedly become a better place for free speech since he took it over. The site itself, though, I don't think necessarily is running all that much better. I think some of the features that have been added and subtracted have not necessarily been positive for user experience. If you look at things like Tesla, like, you know, there's definitely criticisms in the car geek worlds that they're not put together as well as other high-level cars, even though they're incredibly fast. And I've enjoyed riding and driving in Teslas over the years, but like the Cybertruck, I don't get it at all. Like, I don't know if you have one, I'm sorry, but like, I don't get it at all. I mean, every time I see one, I'm like, how is that made? That being said, on the other side, the man is obviously brilliant. He is, I mean, he's the richest man in the world. I don't need to tell you he's been successful in business. But like when you read the details about how he's been successful in business, it shows that he has an undying passion to improve his products. He wants to make everything better all the time. He never takes no for an answer. He pushes through when it's incredibly difficult. He thrashes through government regulations and other experts telling him he can't be done. He's an incredible American story. He has single-handedly basically made it so we don't even need NASA anymore. He's beat everybody in that SpaceX world. He's built companies that are really, really impressive. Tesla is has built an amazing company and really did something that I don't know that anyone ever thought was possible, which is to make kind of Americans take a second look at electric cars as opposed to gas-powered cars. So that's really, really impressive. And, you know, the same stuff he's doing at Doge now, which, of course, we really like and the left really hates, is incredibly consistent with what he's done with company after company after company. This is how this guy operates. When the left loved him, this is how he operated. They just didn't care because he was doing things to instead advance his global warming agenda. Here, he's doing it to cut government waste, and they all hate his guts. Here is the breakdown, by the way, of the American people, their opinion on Elon Musk. If you are a Republican or lean Republican, 73% favorable. Democrat or lean Democrat, 12% favorable. 12% favorable for Elon Musk. This is a guy, if I must remind you. Created an electric car company, created a massive solar power company, created a space company that was largely built to run away from the effects of global warming so we could live on Mars one day. That's who Elon Musk is. How do only 12% of liberals and Democrats have a positive opinion of the guy? How is that freaking possible? Especially when we live in a world where this is so obviously true.
Because the fight to protect our planet is literally a fight for humanity, for generations to come. It may be the only existential threat to all our nations and to all humanity that exists.
The biggest, greatest existential threat to all of humanity. And only 12% of the left has a positive opinion of this guy? It's so fascinating. Now, Elon Musk, of course, first started into high-level politics, and it looked very different, as NBC News notes. He would occasionally flash some overconfidence in the hearing that he had back in 2017. He had a prediction that in 10 years, nearly all cars produced would be autonomous, and that is not close to materializing. Although, I mean, 2027 is still a couple years away. It seems like we're going pretty fast on that road, but I'm sure not all of them on the roads will be. But all cars produced? I mean, a lot of cars have those features. I don't think he's that far off on that one. As he often did back then, Musk posited that Tesla's stock price was too high. His cautious and pragmatic tone in that day in 2017 bears little resemblance to the disruptive and omnipresent force he's become in big tech and President Trump's second administration. And, you know, I can understand why, he's on the side of your opponent now. He voted for him. He endorsed him. He hasn't changed any of his opinions on global warming. But he, you know, doesn't really like your guy anymore. So I can understand why that might drop off a little bit as far as his favorability. And you could see why maybe Republicans would like him more. But 12% favorability, why? Especially when we all know it's definitely true. You've told us a million times. We all know the truth of the matter.
Essential threat of accelerating climate change. It's real. It's serious. We don't have a lot of time. It is the single greatest threat to humanity. It's only by working together that we'll prevent the worst consequences of climate change from ravaging our future and that of our children and grandchildren.
Think about that. It's the greatest threat. It's the threat. I mean, other threats might exist, but this is the threat to worry about. Climate change. As we've heard over and over again, zero emission vehicles, solar power. These are the types of things we need to beat this problem. And yet the guy who built all of that infrastructure, all these massive companies, the only one who's really been able to get anybody interested in this crap is Elon Musk, and he got a 12% approval rating from the Democrats. What does that mean? Why? Now, to be fair, he did go on Joe Rogan a few times, so that does make him a bad person. Now, it's fascinating because now he went on Joe Rogan, and that made the left not like him. Now we're supposed to believe that Joe Rogan's audience is getting mad at Joe Rogan because Joe Rogan likes Elon Musk. That's what we're supposed to believe now. Joe Rogan's infatuation with Elon Musk is angering his fans. This is from Politico. It really embarrasses themselves with this take. But the sudden turn toward Musk. Now, look, I would not say I'm a Joe Rogan fanboy. He has some good interviews, like him sometimes, you know, whatever. He does what he does. I wouldn't say I follow every one of his interviews, but I have watched some of the Elon Musk stuff that he's done. He's always been pretty interested in Elon Musk, at least as long as I've known about it. It's not a sudden turn toward Musk. He's always been fascinated with the guy. He's always been fascinated with futurism and technology and you know, people who will kind of like, maybe smoke a little pot and go into deep, weird worlds with him, right? He's always been interested in that and always been interested in Musk. But we're supposed to understand from Politico that it's a sudden turn toward Musk, who's emerged as a force behind many of the broadest changes in the early weeks of the new administration, is roiling the online spaces where many of his fans, who are used to a more varied and less nakedly pro-administration podcast, gather, including, yes, you're not going to believe it, a liberal opinions coming from Reddit. Oh, my. Wow. The wonders will never cease. At $1.5 million subscriber subreddit dedicated to Rogan, where fans of his podcast congregate to discuss the show and any other Rogan related drama, has in recent days been overrun with memes and other posts complaining about Musk, the Trump administration, and Rogan's recent regular full throated defenses of the work of Doge, the Musk led initiative to slash federal spending. I don't know if you've ever been on Reddit before. No matter what they're talking about donuts. Someone's going to say how bad Donald Trump is over there. Like, that is the very, very liberal space. The fact that they would be upset that he's talking about good things that Elon Musk is doing in the Trump administration is not a surprise and certainly not a reason to write an article. It's basically the most blatantly obvious and basic point you can ever make. People on Reddit say bad things about Donald Trump is not a take. Just so you're aware, especially when more important things are going on. Did you know the most serious problem we're facing right now is this?
Well, first of all, I think it is the existential threat to humanity, climate change. It's the most serious problem we face as human beings.
Now, it would be one thing if Elon Musk were to create all these solutions to the greatest existential threat, the existential threat that we are facing in the world, and then, you know, express some other conservative opinions, like, for example, you know, opening up your factory to make Teslas during COVID a little bit earlier than they wanted him to, or by supporting Donald Trump, or by saying, hey, we need to stop government waste and maybe cut some regulations for businesses. You can understand how maybe he doesn't have a perfect reputation on the left, but considering that he's only at 12%, you'd think that's kind of odd. But maybe you'd think maybe it's going to be a little bit balanced. They'd have a balanced take. That would make sense. But shouldn't it be even better than that? I mean, again, this is the greatest problem that we have. We've been told by Joe Biden many, many times today how important this problem is to solve. And here's the guy who's actually doing something. But he's not just doing something like creating a viable electric car company, right? That would be, and by the way, we've seen companies like Nikola and so many others, Fisker and so many others, fail when they've tried to go down this road. I mean, Barack Obama made promises back in his administration that millions and millions and millions of these vehicles would be out there and everyone would be driving them. And of course, none of that ever happened until long after Barack Obama was gone. It only happened when Elon Musk showed up and decided he wanted to do it. So wouldn't you have a better opinion of him just based on that? But it's more than that. It's not just making a company viable. It's making somehow electric vehicles cool to conservatives. That is a freaking test. I have a friend who is a hardcore MAGA guy, like a guy who is, he's absolutely 100% behind MAGA, does not want to hear word one from anyone saying anything liberal. He'll get in arguments with you he does not care. He's one of those guys that just does not care. He just sold his giant truck and traded it in for a freaking Tesla, a Plaid. Another friend who's, he's a little granola on the conservative side, but this guy, he'll tell you over and over again, he's come all the way from Colorado to here over and over again on Elon Musk's Tesla, which he owns, I believe, two of, on auto drive, because he loves the technology. Elon Musk has made this cool even for conservatives. Let me give you another example, because this one seems like impossible. Imagine someone who's a conservative supporting solar power. We know that doesn't happen, right? Let me give you a picture of one. This man, our own Chris Cruz, there he is. If you are on podcast, he is wearing a Trump 2024 t-shirt. He's got a Make America Great Again hat. He is carrying a Trump flag. On his belly is a picture of the president with his fist in the air saying, fight, 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 with blood dripping down his face. This is how he went when he went to go vote. That's the outfit he wore. He is a producer, of course, for Pat Gray Unleashed and many other shows here at the Blaze Network. Blaze TV. He's at Blaze TV. He's wearing that to the polls. You know what else he does when he goes home, when he's watching Netflix? He's got it powered by freaking Elon Musk solar panels. Chris freaking Cruz at the Blaze has somehow been won over by Elon Musk and his technology and has made solar power cool. That's the heaviest lift of all. You got that guy with solar panels on his house? And by the way, don't ask him, because he'll show you the app and he'll show you exactly how much power he's used in the last couple weeks because he's obsessed with it. This is something that should be celebrated by the left. And instead, he's got a 12% approval rating. He somehow made electric cars and solar power cool to conservatives, and yet he's got a 12% approval rating on the left. How does that happen? How does that happen? How is he not the patron saint of leftism? He's taken all of their most important issues and not only made them cool to liberals who all bought them, and people like, you know, AOC had their Teslas. Now they're like, we're selling our Teslas because we no longer like them. Well, that's interesting. Why? If he's solving one of the biggest problems out there, why would it be that way? And it's just fascinating to see it happen over and over and over again, especially when we're supposed to believe that this is true.
You know, I've toured many sites across the country that clearly show climate change is a genuine, is the existential threat to humanity. The existential threat to humanity.
The existential threat to humanity. So how do you explain this? And there is one easy explanation, by the way. Of course, it's partially that they never believed that. They never believed that a 0.9 degrees Celsius rise over a century was the greatest existential threat to humanity. It's obviously insane to believe that. There's a million problems that are much more consequential than that, as we've covered 1,000 times. But what it does reveal is what their actual real belief is when it comes to the greatest existential threat to humanity. That threat for them, for the left, the greatest existential threat to Democrats is Democrats being out of power. It's liberals losing their little slush funds. It's the left finally not being able to grab control of the entire economy and do with it whatever they want. The real threat to liberals is liberals being out of power. The real threat to the left is the left not owning your life and every little bit of it. The real problem when it comes to all these situations and Democrats and everybody who keeps complaining about this is not, of course, global warming. It's themselves not being able to control your life. All right, picture this. You're ready to sell your home, but there's one problem. The kitchen kind of just screams 1990s. Like, you're in real trouble here. You're well behind the times. And you know, you're going to sell your house. Is it really going to work? Probably not. Before you drop thousands on renovations, though, wouldn't you want to know if that money was worth it? How about a cost-benefit analysis? This is where realestateagentsitrust.com steps in, connecting you with a top-notch real estate agent. This platform ensures that you get the best advice. Maybe even that kitchen upgrade isn't necessary. Perhaps a more simple cosmetic refresh could suffice, making your home appealing without emptying your wallet. Or consider another scenario. You're looking to buy your, a home, and your agent points you to a future hotspot, place that's growing, saving you some money up front and then setting you up for a big return down the road. With realestateagentsitrust.com, you gain access to professionals who understand the nuances of the market. It's a strategic partnership that could steer you clear of costly mistakes and maximize your investment. And the best part, it's a free service to you. So why not see a difference that, you know, that is major in your life? What difference can the right agent make for you? Check it out now, realestateagentsitrust.com. It's a free service to you, realestateagentsitrust.com.
Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Cool, wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Hol dir dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer.
Last year, I did a documentary here for Blaze TV. It's called Countdown to the Next Aviation Disaster. And it was released in November, about 70 days before the next major aviation disaster. In my documentary, we ask a lot of questions, and we focus a lot on the FAA and, you know, what is happening there with staffing and technology and all sorts of different things. But it's not the only question that's worth asking. And I kept coming back to the idea over and over again that, like, when you really look at the details of what happened in Washington, D.C., I don't know that it takes like a major, you know, documentary or investigation to figure out that everything that was going on in that area was a bad idea and something was bound to happen. I want to bring in Ari Shulman. He writes for The New Atlantis, and he has a great piece on trying to ask a lot of important questions about this. It's called, If the Reagan Airport Crash Was Waiting to Happen, Why Didn't Anyone Stop It? I feel like this happens all the time in our society, and I ask the same question so often. I wanted to bring him in to talk about it. You can find a link to it, by the way, on my X page. Ari, thanks so much for coming on the program. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Like, and I want to let me start here because not only did you write a really interesting piece about this, you actually were in the area when this crash occurred. Can you tell this story briefly?
Yeah, so I actually saw the crash. I live right next to Reagan Airport. I'm 2 miles south of it. And the George Washington Parkway, which is the major highway that connects DC to Alexandria, runs right along the airport. So if you're driving along that road, you're running right parallel to the landing flight path about half a mile away from it. And I'm an aviation guy, so I always look over at the planes as they're coming in when I'm driving. And this time I happened to look over and I saw the collision. I think I looked over, it was probably about a quarter of a second after the collision happened. And I looked before that and seen this plane coming in, level, normal flight, everything looked fine. Looked back at the road and then looked back again and saw the plane on its side. And I saw a huge spray of sparks spreading out from it. Distinctly, I think notably, I didn't see any helicopter. I only saw this plane. So the helicopter, obviously it was there, but it was very hard to see, and the plane was very easy to see.
I mean, just an incredible thing to obviously witness. And, you know, as an aviation guy, it had to make you think right away. You pass this airport all the time. You're looking at this area all the time. You're seeing helicopters and planes flying through the same sort of intersection all the time. You probably had that thought of, wait a minute, like something's going to happen here at some point. And I think a lot of people, when you look at the details of this, kind of said, hey, wait a minute, this is just an accident waiting to happen. You write about this in The New Atlantis. It's a great piece. And I think it hits more than just the aviation industry. It's a really obvious and recurring thing that happens after every tragedy. We all look at the details and say, wait a minute, how did we not pick this up before? As you're thinking about this, you know, what did you conclude?
Yeah, so in that particular case, I hadn't thought of that before because there is a place where the helicopter flight path crosses over the landing plane flight path, but it's out over the river. It's not an area that's really easy to see. It was an odd coincidence. There's a little stretch of that highway where you happen to be able to see that spot, but it was otherwise not something that I or anyone else really would be able to know about because you can't really see it very well. You do know that there are tons of planes in that area. And you know there are tons of helicopters, and you hear it, and sometimes it's unnerving when they pass over your head, and you just think, they've got it figured out. Apparently, they didn't have it figured out, and it was the sort of thing that I think if the general public had known that there was a helicopter flight path crossing over a landing plane flight path, and there was a Washington Post analysis that found that at their closest approach, they were 15 vertical feet apart, any normal person would have been able to tell you, that's crazy, and it's going to cause a plane crash eventually. So the question I was asking was, why did nobody in the aviation flight system put that together? The answer is a lot of people had put it together, including pilots who had landed along that path before and had almost hit helicopters. There are incident reports going back over 30 years of the near misses of that kind. So then the question is, well, if that was even in the aviation system, why didn't that information get to the top and they cut it out and stopped that? And the answer that I came to, I think it's a particularly important question with the aviation system, because the aviation system actually is a marvel of safety practices and of evolving safety over time. We just had this 15-year period where there was no major air collision in the United States, which was unthinkable. If you were in the 70s or the 80s or the 90s, I don't think anyone would have ever thought that the air safety system would have succeeded like that. And yet here, even this safe system failed in this way. And what I was arguing is that the pattern that you find when there are these crashes and somebody afterwards says, we knew this was going to happen, the pattern is that it involves decisions that were so significant and so sort of existential in stakes that for somebody in the system to have tried to undo that decision would have required a fundamental legitimacy crisis for the system. It would have admitted that something inherent in the system was mistaken, some program that they were undertaking, some mandate that they had.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. You kind of illustrate this in the piece with this deviation death spiral, which I thought was really a fascinating way to look at it, because it, as you point out, really does apply to the aviation industry. And basically, to describe it to the podcast listeners, you kind of go out and you make a decision and then you have no failure with that decision. So you create a new normal and it spirals out farther, and then you have no failure again and it creates a new normal. And then eventually you hit this, tragic situation, which seems crazy from the beginning of that spiral. But when you look at it from just the most previous lack of failure, if you will, It's not that crazy. It reminded me of almost like someone who, has a drink at a bar and drives home and has no problems. And then the next time has two drinks and drives home and has no problems. And then at some point they're at like eight drinks, they're driving home, and then they have a crash or they get pulled over and their life is destroyed. These sorts of decisions are all over our government, all throughout major important systems like aviation. And honestly, it's a pretty human thing, I think, to have happen. How do you prevent it?
There are all sorts of techniques for preventing it. And again, I think one of the interesting things is that the aviation system is one of the best examples of having prevented this kind of crash, which makes it distinctly interesting that it failed in this case. You can do it by having the sort of safety systems that the FAA has, where pilots report near misses, and then you have people whose job it is to go into the system and kind of try to work backwards from that to what are the underlying causes and how do you proactively prevent that. One of the biggest mechanisms in the air safety system is after a crash, they'll read reports by the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, and they'll do these great analyses of what went wrong and come up with proposals to patch the plugs. And decades of that put together led to the safety of the system that we have. And yet in this case, it failed. And I think the reason that the human factors slipped through here is that in order to prevent this crash, the FAA would have had to do something that would have threatened its power, potentially. This is my speculation, right? Mm-hmm. But what you had here is you had the FAA at National Airport having to manage an enormous and kind of crazy number of different constraints. It was having to manage the busiest runway in the entire country is at National Airport. You have extremely sensitive airspace over the White House, the Mall, and the Pentagon. There are two nearby military bases. And the big thing is one of these military bases is running training missions to ferry around VIPs in these helicopters, which is one of the main reasons that the flight path is being used. So essentially, you would have had to have the FAA tell the military and various other agencies in DC, sorry, but we don't think that your ferrying VIPs around is important enough to jeopardize air travel. And apparently something went wrong where they had the information to know that that decision needed to be made, and they didn't make that decision.
It's so tragic. It's such a tragic failure. Another thing you talk about in the piece, which I thought was really interesting, is a thing that I think everybody goes through. Like, I sit here on a Sunday and I'm watching the NFL and I'm screaming at my team, you know, why aren't you running more? Why aren't you passing more? Why aren't you blitzing more? And like, I'm just a guy. I don't really know what I'm talking about. Of course, when it comes to really complicated NFL offenses and defenses, I'm just a fan. And, you know, we all have those moments where we say, gosh, why don't they just do it this way? And so often, those things are wrong, right? You don't understand the real details behind it. You don't understand the inner machinations of how all this stuff works. But as you point out in the piece, you know, it seems that a lot of times you are right. Sometimes the person who's just commenting on Twitter, who just says, this doesn't make any sense, is right to not make any sense. How do these giant systems how are they able to identify when, you know, the average Joe has one of these things right, which I think they would have in this case, as opposed to just, you know, everybody saying everything and coming up with crazy ideas that don't make any sense?
That's a terrific question. I think that's the most important question that needs to be asked right now. I don't know of the answer to it. I don't know of anyone else who knows the answer to it. And I don't even know of many people who are asking it. But it is the pattern with these kinds of things. I talked about several other examples from NASA, the loss of the two space shuttles, and even from the FAA, so the grounding of the MAX planes a few years ago. That was another example of this, right? Anyone on the street could have told you, if you have a system in an airplane that is designed to override the pilot controls and potentially push the plane down, first of all, that seems like a bit of a perilous idea. And if it does work, you want to make sure that it's reliable and has multiple points of, that it doesn't have a single point of failure. There isn't one thing that can go wrong and make this system trigger accidentally. But that's exactly what happened, and it crashed two planes. There was a single sensor driving the system. It overrode the pilot controls, and two planes that were in normal flight, the computer systems mistakenly believed that they were stalling, and they forced the planes into the ground. So the thing that I think that the safety system hasn't figured out is how specifically do you identify these exact sorts of problems where actually only the man on the street or the man on the street has a distinct advantage in recognizing these things. With the MAX, the problem was it was going to be really hard for the system to recognize this because the upshot of recognizing this problem was going to be we might need to ground this entire new fleet that Boeing, the leading aviation manufacturer in the United States, has staked its entire strategy on. That was just a huge decision. It was an inherently political one because it would have been so disruptive. And it was just going to be tough for the FAA to do that. It was a decision that was going to require some sort of higher authority, Congress or the president, saying a bigger solution here is required than just more process. And the problem is that often what happens is that attention and that political mandate to make that bigger kind of change doesn't come in until you get the deadly disaster. So if you're in the FAA, if you're an air safety expert, or if you're the president, or if you're Congress, you want to be asking, how can we get out of this pattern where it takes deadly disasters for us to finally recognize and get the will to patch these problems? How can we get that will before they actually happen?
Yeah, it's really, really tough. And of course, if you do wait until that disaster happens, not only do you have the disaster, but you also have a loss of faith from the, you know, the American people looking at these institutions and these experts. It really makes this very, very complicated. You're the only one I know thinking through this stuff, Ari, so I wanted to bring you on. I really appreciate it. It's a great piece. It's called If the Reagan Airport Crash Was Waiting to Happen, Why Didn't Anyone Stop It? It's available at the New Atlantis. So those guys are always writing really interesting things over there. I really appreciate it, Ari. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Sue.
Kaffee in seiner besten Form mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Tchibo. In jeder Cubo-Kapsel steckt Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Für Espresso, Kaffeecrema oder Kaffee Grande auf Knopfdruck. Die neue Cubo One überzeugt mit Premium-Design, kompakter Größe und kleinem Einstiegspreis ab 29 Euro. Dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie wird jede Tasse besonders aromatisch mit samtiger Crema. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Tchibo-Filiale und auf tchibo.de.
Well, the U.S. has now declared Mexican cartels terrorist organizations, several of them. And this is, of course, on top of this, we were talking about Elon Musk earlier. He tweeted that they are now eligible for drone strikes. Hey, you're eligible. Congratulations for drone strikes. This is a fascinating thing because we obviously know the problems that these cartels create. And this is a big source of, obviously, the fentanyl and other things that are coming across the border. They do all sorts of terrible things inside the country and export a bunch of it to our country as well. I do think, though, we have a bit of an incorrect impression as to how easy it's going to be to take out the cartels. Like, these are real, like, basically paramilitary organizations. We could do it with full invasions, I'm sure, and things like that, but it really, really difficult to do. And just a few drone strikes here and there are not only not going to get the job done, but also are going to create all sorts of other outcomes that we're not going to like this much. We should see if we can get Jesse Kelly on next week about this, because he's been talking about this a lot. And I think it's really interesting because I think the American people kind of sees this as like an episode of 24, you know, like, oh, we'll just take them out. going to be really hard to do that. And there is a lot going on behind the scenes when that comes to that. I will say we are taking really good steps on the border and making our border safer every single day. Illegal border crossings continuing to fall in the early weeks of the Trump administration. We've known some of this is going on. We now have a graph to kind of show you what it looks like. Obviously, way down from the Biden days, even from the later Biden days after his executive order put in a bunch of the policies that Trump had in initially. We see a massive cut in illegal border crossings. In fact, the lowest we've seen certainly since 2021 and honestly long before that as well. So that is working, and Trump is able to do this on the border, has succeeded so far. We'll see how long that continues to go on. My guess is because this is such a priority, you're going to see a lot more success on the border. It's something that Trump really does take seriously. Some of the stuff he talks about, you know, it's just not central to his interest. He'll kind of give it lip service here and there, won't necessarily stick around. This one, though, he cares about, and he's on it every single day. And so is Tom Homan, which is really promising as well. Mitch McConnell is not going to be on it for much longer. He's 83 years old, and he will not seek re-election in 2026. What a tragedy. I mean, he's in the prime of his Senate life here. I mean, the guy's got to have six or seven good terms in him left, right? I mean, he's only 83. You got to feel like if you're a senator, you know, you don't necessarily want to go above 250 years old. But anything before that, I think you are running for re-election. So the prime, just struck down that career in the prime of his life. 83 years old, he's out. And that's very, very sad, I am sure. I will say, warning to Kentucky, sometimes you make some bad decisions. I will point out your governor, for example. Occasionally, Democrats can win in a red state like Kentucky, and you better make sure you get somebody who's really, really good to run and replace Mitch McConnell. Because the one thing about McConnell was he would win. And you might say, well, yeah, but he'd win. But what would he do while he was in Congress? Well, he'd still vote with Trump 85% of the time, 80% of the time, 75% of the time. That's not great. You'd want something better than that. And sometimes his votes have been sometimes he's been pretty good on this stuff. I will say the Supreme Court, I think you could make the argument that he's more responsible for the Supreme Court majority than even Trump is, because he was one that blocked the vote back on Merrick Garland back in the day. He could at least make that argument, though I don't think he would have got through anyway on Republican watch. But anyway, the long story short is Mitch McConnell going away, and you saw his whatever friends he had in Congress have pretty much disappeared anyway. So that's where that one stands. And finally, we were getting some interesting information from inside of Congress. George Santos, who very rarely tells the truth, has finally told the truth. He is now talking to Jim Norton about the smelliest person in Congress, who is, quote, every step of his waddle is a fart, is the quote. And it's funny, when I say that quote, without telling you who the smelliest person in Congress is, I bet you know who it is. If I say every step of his waddle is a fart, you probably know I'm talking about Jerry Nadler, right? Didn't you know I was talking about Jerry Nadler? I will say I don't think I've ever believed anything George Santos has said before, but this one I completely believe. The quote is, I can say this with no mental reservations, the worst body odor in Congress is definitely Jerry Nadler. It's so bad, Jerry Nadler would waddle down that aisle and crop dust it. Yeah, it was every step of his waddle was a fart. The dude just stinks. He's greasy and oily. Ew, take a shower, Jerry Nadler. Again, I don't know that a truer analysis has ever been brought to you. So at least we're getting something out of the you know, what was it, 6-week reign of George Santos. Okay, so here's what happened. You know, charities are a really important part of our country, you know that? Charities that work really hard, especially as we covered at the beginning of the show, when they're working against the greatest existential threat our country is facing. And that's global warming, as you know. One organization, it is called Power Forward Communities. Yeah, this is really important piece of the puzzle. You know, water pumps and solar panels and home battery systems and EV chargers. Well, you know, they're really important, and they're working on that. They actually put out one press release in their entire history, and it talked about using some money from the EPA to do that. Now, up until this time, they had been open for 3 months, and they had made $100 in donations. So kind of interesting that we've now uncovered through Doge that this organization, which is tied to Stacey Abrams, by the way, is receiving $2 billion in funding. Now, when you have $100 in revenue, shocking that you might get $2 billion in funding. There's a lot to go through on this, and we may have to get to this again next week, looking deep into this, because there's a lot more here. $2 billion going to a Stacey Abrams organization. This is the sort of stuff we can really sink our teeth into the blaze. And by the way, if you happen to want to sink your teeth into another really deep dive, Matt Kibbe has a documentary series called The Cover-Up. It's here now. The Cover-Up, Smoking Gun is the latest episode. It's on Blaze TV, out right now. You can subscribe at FauciCoverUp.com/Stu, FauciCoverUp.com/Stu. Use the code Smoking Gun. You get $30 off your subscription. This has been a great series, and this is just the latest example of it. FauciCoverUp.com/Stu. The code is Smoking Gun. You can save $30 off your subscription to Blaze TV, which also gives you access not only to this show, of course, but all the great shows here on the network. Plus, you get to watch the radio show live for 3 hours every single day. And, you know, access to Glenn's special TV shows, lots of behind the scenes stuff. And you can chat with the radio show during the radio show. That's a new feature we're featuring lately. So check it out. FauciCoverUp.com/Stu.